Hello, I'm Jordan Aileen. This is number 0339, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0339. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not is back on the program to share some interesting trivia about U.S. presidents.
Washington was the first American millionaire, but almost all of his wealth was in land. He's a tobacco farmer, so no hardcore cash. Believe it or not, he had to borrow $1,500 to get to his own inauguration.
Science writer Andrew Vizakis, the night sky guy, talks about the discovery of gravitational waves.
What scientists have come up with is a great analogy, is like throwing a pebble into a pond, and you have the ripples coming out from that splash that you've made. If you sort of put that into the big picture of the universe, then those ripples are really the gravitational waves we're talking about, those ripples traveling through the cosmos, through the universe, and sort of creating this ripple or wave, shock wave in the fabric of space and time.
Actress and screenwriter Kim Kopp talks about her new project, a medical horror film called Experiment 77. Where did the idea for the story come from?
Actually, I started writing it as a form of therapy. A family member was put into a mental institution against her will. I was not able to help her and 3,000 miles away. And so I started writing, just trying to get my thoughts out, the horror that she was going through. And eventually just turned into a screenplay. It was originally a psychological thriller, but then it was really horrifying, so I thought, why not just make it into a horror?
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0339 was Jordan Aileen, my nephew. Thank you very much, buddy, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? As you know by listening to this show, there definitely is something special about the state of Florida and the people who are in it. The state on the map that dangles like a, well, it dangles, is home to an eccentricity that is second to none. Perhaps it's proof positive that people are products of their environments. Case in point, a Florida man who picked a bizarre method to try and steal a free meal. 23-year-old Joshua James pulled up to a Wendy's drive-thru in Loxahatchee, Florida, and ordered a meal and a drink. But after getting his hands on the grub, he didn't hand over any money. Instead, he threw a 3.5-foot alligator into the window of the drive-thru. A live alligator. He was later arrested by U.S. Marshals. James was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, illegally killing, possessing, or capturing an alligator, and second-degree larceny petty theft. Assault with a deadly weapon? Since when is an alligator considered a weapon? Anyway, a Wisconsin jury has convicted a man who blamed eating beer-battered fish when he was picked up for his 10th drunken driving offense. The Adams County jury found 76-year-old John Prisabella of Friendship, Wisconsin, guilty. He could face up to 12 and a half years in prison. A criminal complaint says Prisabella told a deputy who stopped him in October 2014 that the reason he smelled of alcohol was because he had been at a fish fry and had eaten beer-battered fish. Court documents say a preliminary breath test showed that he had a 0.062% blood alcohol concentration. The legal limit for Wisconsin residents with three or more drunken driving convictions is 0.02%. Okay, go ahead, say it. The jury thought the story was fishy. Yeah, I went there. Firefighters in Costa Blanca, Spain were called to an unusual rescue last week when they had to use specialist cutting tools to free a 36-year-old man's member. The Lithuanian man arrived at the hospital after a kinky sex game went wrong and four metal rings got stuck on his penis. But doctors had to call in the assistance of local firefighters to remove the steel rings with specialist cutting equipment. The steel rings were so thick that two cuts had to be made in each in order to pry them off the delicate body part while cooling fluid was applied to avoid burning from the electric circular saw. I'm sorry. I just get a little queasy when I hear male member and circular saw in the same discussion. Now, where were we? Oh, yes. It's not the first time that the hospital has called us out to cut off rings, but usually they are from someone's finger, said Station Chief Javier Feos. The team of firefighters took almost an hour to remove all the metal rings. So, I guess these rings aren't one size fits all, huh? Seriously, do you think in the future this guy is going to brag about his ordeal? Mind you, we might only be talking about girth here. Elsewhere, a man in Kristiansand, Norway, woke up to the sound of his car engine starting. He raced out and saw his car being stolen, so he grabbed a door handle and held on. The thief tried to shake the man off, but the owner climbed onto the roof and held on as the car sped off. With the thief driving at speeds of up to 90 kilometers per hour, the man smashed in the back window with his knee and grappled with the thief until the car crashed into a bridge's safety barrier. The police took the thief into custody, and the victim, wearing nothing but his underwear with an outside temperature of minus 17 degrees Celsius, was left pretty bloody, according to police. Bruce Willis wouldn't have managed that, Police Chief Jan Neslin said. It's not something we would advise people to do, but now that he's done it, well, it's an incredible story. You know, if I'm in my underwear and someone steals my car on a night when it's minus 17 degrees, my first thought would be, what's the number for my insurance company again? Meanwhile, a pair of tourists filmed getting a little too frisky in Las Vegas on their enormous observation Ferris wheel were arrested on charges of committing sex acts in public. Authorities say 27-year-old Philip Frank Panzica III of Houston and 21-year-old Chloe Scordianos of Hicksville, New York, were the only passengers in cabin 16 of the 550-foot diameter high roller observation wheel on Friday afternoon. A security officer noticed the pair smoking cigarettes and undressing. The wheel's operator told police workers he used an intercom to ask the passengers to please put all cigarettes out and put all clothes back on. The pair briefly complied, but soon resumed both forbidden activities. Police were called when the pair refused the second request to halt their sexual encounter, the operator said. The suspects were charged on felony charges of committing a sex act in public. They were later released on bond. You see, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, unless, of course, it highly annoys Vegas. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Arkansas couple's evening of kinky entertainment ended with one pair of handcuffs used for fun being replaced by another used for real in an arrest. 21-year-old Dustin Taylor called police this week to his home in Fort Smith to remove a pair of handcuffs he told officers he and his wife had been using the previous night while doing some kinky things, the official report stated. The couple had lost the key, Taylor explained, and the responding patrolman removed the handcuffs and did a routine search of Taylor's name in a police database. When the computer reported an outstanding warrant for Taylor on criminal mischief, handcuffs went back on. But this time, they belonged to the officer. Sergeant Daniel Grubbs, spokesman for the Fort Smith Police, expressed a measure of sympathy for Taylor. "I sort of wish the guy had invested in an extra handcuff key," Grubbs said. Yeah, you know, most people who have outstanding warrants tend to avoid calling the police. I almost made this guy the idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes later. Instead, I'll offer just a few words of advice. Next time, instead of calling the cops, call a locksmith. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? In the U.S., the third Monday in February is President's Day, and our friends to the south are also in the midst of a somewhat bizarre, never-ending presidential campaign. So this has given us an excuse to welcome back on the show Edward Meyer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not. He's here to talk about some of the strange facts about presidents. Edward joins us on the line from Florida. Hi, Edward.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for having us on again.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. So what are some of the odd stories or items that you can share with us that deal with U.S. presidents?
Well, President's Day is a pretty big deal down here. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was Washington Day and there was Lincoln Day, and now they're sort of the same deal. Washington and Lincoln have been the Ripley favorites probably since day one. And Mr. Ripley himself always drew a new cartoon about Washington on Washington's birthday or about Lincoln on Lincoln's. And going through the years, we've assembled quite a few things on those two presidents specifically, but others as well. The bicentennial in 1976 is the only, you know, true history book Ripley has published. But we put a bunch of our stuff in there, and some of these go back that far.
Wow.
George Washington was the first American millionaire, but almost all of his wealth was in land. He's a tobacco farmer, so no hardcore cash. Believe it or not, he had to borrow $1,500 to get to his own inauguration.
And when you think about it, $1,500 is a lot of money back in the late 1700s.
Well, I'd say it's a lot of cash. It's a hard, you know, when things, even the currency from that period is, you know, 1 and 2 cents. You know, you can get a 2 cent dollar bill, you know, if you understand what I mean. But $1,500 is indeed a lot of cash. And, you know, so he has to borrow money. He gets to New York City, to his inauguration, and everybody knows, I think, at this point in our lives that he had bad teeth. George had false teeth. There's a famous set of dentures made from elk antlers. There's another set made out of wood. Well, on inauguration day, he was having some serious dental problems. And as he talked, it sounded like he was whistling. There was a buzz through the hole in his teeth. So he made the decision to keep the speech short, a record short speech, still one of the shortest, if not the shortest ever, 183 words, less than 90 seconds. Basically a paragraph and a half is all George had to say on his first inauguration, showing that, you know, he meant business right from the start.
Wow. Now, I understand, speaking of Washington, he refused to shake hands with anyone during his terms as president?
Well, one of the things that, you know, it's kind of a two-edged sword, sort of, you know, a bit of a puzzle, paradox. Washington was a very formal person, yet he did not want to be called king. At the time, you know, the word president came up in debate because they couldn't decide what to call him, and a lot of people thought he should have been king or emperor, but he didn't want any part of that. Yet, he thought the office of the president was so high above the common people that he would not shake hands. For the entire 8 years he was in office, he insisted on bowing, and he insisted on being called Mr. President, which is still today how we address the president of the country.
I like his style. Now, let's move on to Abraham Lincoln, because you say that's the other president that was featured a lot in Ripley's over the years. He had a pet turkey in the White House?
Pet turkey. Several presidents have had some unusual pets, goats, bears, alligators. But Lincoln's son, Tad, had a turkey named Jack, and it is Lincoln's, you know, kind of in jest, kind of having fun with his kid, pardons Jack the turkey And it's from that that we have the tradition that every year the president has a, you know, a very formal little pardon of a turkey on Thanksgiving Day. It relates back to one actual turkey that, you know, the kid cried enough that dad said, no, okay, we won't have turkey for Thanksgiving this year.
Now, when you mentioned Washington's inauguration and the brevity of his speech, that is not necessarily the situation when it came to the words of Abraham Lincoln. He wrote a lot, didn't he?
Yes. And Lincoln is my favorite president for several reasons, but this being one of them. I think of Lincoln as the great orator. You know, the vision of him standing up at Gettysburg and addressing the people, the public. But in terms of writing, Abraham Lincoln wrote more words during his very brief, not even, 4 years in office, just public letters, not the grocery list, not the, letter home to the wife or anything, 1,078,365 words. Let me try that again. 1,078,365 words, which is a greater figure by almost a whole 100,000 than are in the Bible, and 25,000 more than in the complete works of William Shakespeare. Now, add those words, material written by Lincoln, with material written about Lincoln. At last count, over 14,000 books. The only person there's more written about is Jesus. And Napoleon a close second.
Wow.
Put his writings with writings about him, and you would have a massive library.
And one more Lincoln fact. They had moved his body, his coffin, 17 times after his funeral?
Well, this is... I guess there's a couple reasons for this. The fear of tampering, grave robbing, and that he was, on a trip from Washington to his homeland, and they stopped at several spots, and everybody wanted a piece of Lincoln, not literally, but there was great debate where he should end up. Hmm. Now the majority of exhibitry that we have on Lincoln is all related to his funeral. Pieces of his coffin, pieces of the crepe that decorated the hearse, etc. But I think, two things, and they're both related to the assassination, but two of my favorite Lincoln things is we actually have a lock of his hair taken from the operation trying to save his life, removing the bullet from his head. And we have a gun that belonged to John Wilkes Booth. It's a proper Derringer. Most people know the word Derringer and think of just a small gun, but he was an actual gun maker, and it's a particular style. But a John Wilkes Booth Derringer. When he shot Lincoln from behind, he jumped over the balcony onto the stage of the Ford Theater. This particular gun fell out of his vest and was recovered at the murder scene, sitting there on the stage. The posse chased him out the door and took several days to, gun him down. When they found Booth, they found another matching Derringer, perfect set, so a pair of these vest pocket Derringers. Well, until 1972, 107 years later, it took modern ballistics to figure out which was actually the murder weapon. And for the bulk of that 107 years, most people believed the gun found on the stage was the murder weapon because it was found where he was murdered. Well, we own that gun. Now, in 1972, they proved that it wasn't the murder weapon. And the other pistol is now in the Ford Theater, beautifully displayed. But Ripley's has a Wilkes Booth gun that played an amazingly significant part in American history. And I think it is one of our true treasures displayed in our Baltimore auditorium.
Well, we have just about a minute. We just have about a minute to go here, and I want to touch on your exhibits. I mean, besides finding out information in your books, there are exhibits people can go and see, right?
32 auditoriums in 10 countries around the world. Closest to Montreal, it would either be Toronto or New York City. And our collection is roughly 30,000 artifacts. Most are not history bent, but we have a substantial presidential collection, things concerning Lincoln, Roosevelt, Ulysses S. Grant, Andrew Jackson, even the Obama family, carved in the eye of a needle by an English gentleman named Willard Wiggins, one of the smallest but most unbelievable things in our collection.
Wow. So, and again, people, I'm sure, can go to your website at ripleys.com to find out where the nearest exhibit to them is located, correct?
As well as the price and hours of operation, and a whole lot of other information about Ripley and Ripley's in general. But all the data needed for an auditorium visit can be found at ripleys.com.
Excellent. Edward, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Well, thanks for having us, and look forward to talking to you again when the next book comes out.
Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. We will definitely talk to him when the next book comes out. In the meantime, the title of their current annual is Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0339, and you'll find links to Ripley's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about gravitational waves. Plus, we'll meet the actress and screenwriter behind the scary film Experiment 77. Yes, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way. Plus, lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way to listen to radio. Well, there are several people who seem to be clueless when it comes to items on their person. We have 3 such people. Number 1, when 46-year-old Robert Lee Thomas Jr. was stopped by an Indian River County Sheriff's deputy in Vero Beach, Florida, he allegedly tossed a loaded pistol magazine aside. Deputies searched him and found crack cocaine in his pants pocket. Thomas then claimed the pants he was wearing were not his, although everything else in his pockets, other than the drugs, were his. Yeah. Meanwhile, Palm Beach County, Florida sheriff's deputies were booking 21-year-old Amanda M. Alvarez into jail on charges of possession of drug paraphernalia. As jailers searched her, they found a small plastic bag tucked underneath her left breast. No, don't worry, Alvarez didn't claim that the breast wasn't hers, but she did claim that she did not know the bag was there. The contents tested positive for heroin. Two charges were added to her list: possession of heroin and introduction of contraband into a detention facility, which is a felony. And when 38-year-old Dusty Ray Ingram was being booked into the Okaloosa County Jail, jailers found a plastic bag with pills tucked into her genitals. Ingram said she normally keeps the pills in her purse and doesn't know how they got into her genitals. Alrighty then. If you're walking around with a bag of pills tucked into your genitals and you don't know or remember how they got there, then you have the attention span of a goldfish. Yeah. Meanwhile, Cass County, North Dakota Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to a home in Horace on a report of an explosion. As they arrived, a car sped away from the house, so deputies chased it. It led them to a hospital. And Stephen William Green told deputies he had bought explosive fireworks and one went off in his hand, causing a severe injury. All by itself? Well, no. Alexandria Lang, who drove the car and said she was Green's housekeeper, says when Green got the fireworks, she saw ash from his cigarette drop onto one of the fuses. Green hesitated. He said he thought he should throw the firework into the next room, but didn't because he knew his dogs and a propane tank were in that room. Now, while he was deciding what to do, the device exploded. Lang had enough time to go pick up her 19-month-old son and shield him. Deputies went to his house with a search warrant to gather evidence and found blood spattered all over the kitchen walls and a marijuana grow operation. Once Green is released from the hospital, he faces criminal charges. The fuse, yeah, it was kind of slow. His thinking process, however, much, much slower. Christopher Lemick Jr. was arrested in Palmer, Massachusetts in January and charged in a New Year's Eve hit-and-run accident that took a pedestrian's life. Lemick emerged as a suspect a few days after the collision when police, visiting his home, noticed freshly disturbed earth in his backyard. Eventually, Lemick confessed to literally burying the evidence, using a construction vehicle to crush his truck and an excavator to dig up his backyard and drop the truck into it. Okay, not the brightest bulb. I mean, the idea that he could cube his vehicle and then bury it in his own backyard sounds like a Rube Goldberg kind of plan for getting rid of evidence. But he couldn't drive it off a pier or something? Anyway, not a bright guy. The 20-year New York marriage of Gabriel Villa, now 90, and Christina Carta Villa, now 59, apparently had its happy moments, but as Christina found out when things went bad recently, Gabriel had attempted to protect himself just months after the wedding by obtaining a Dominican Republic divorce and keeping it secret. Christina found out only when she realized in a property accounting that her name was not on the deed of their New York apartment. She is challenging that divorce as improper, even under Dominican law. Wow, that husband is a piece of work. Happy Valentine, dear. Yikes. Months after they got married, he got a Dominican divorce. That was 20 years ago. Yikes. Anyway. Moving right along, it's truly sad and for the cops relatively easy when the written word trips up criminals. I have two examples of that right now. Number one, 55-year-old Briton Jacqueline Patrick was sentenced to 15 years in prison in December for the 2013 murder of her husband, accomplished by spiking his wine with antifreeze. To cover her crime, she handed over a note that the husband had supposedly written, requesting that if tragedy struck him, he wished not to be resuscitated, preferring to die with dignity. Spelt D-I-G-N-E-R-T-Y. Suspicious, police asked Patrick to spell dignity. which of course came out D-I-G-N-E-R-T-Y. Oopsie. And story number two, Christina Green, who was 19, and Gary Withers, who was 38, both already on probation, were arrested in Encinitas, California in December after an Amazon.com driver reported them following his delivery truck and scooping up packages as soon as he dropped them off. Inside the pair's car, officers found numerous parcels and mail addressed to others, plus a to-do list that read, "Steal mail and shoplift." You know, sometimes the court system really has it easy. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, chiropractor William D'Angelo of Stratford, Connecticut, was charged with assault in January after an employee complained that she was ordered to lie down on a table and let D'Angelo apply electrical shocks to her back as punishment for being the office gossiper, spreading rumors about colleagues. D'Angelo said he was reacting to complaints from patients and staff, but seemed to suggest in a statement to police that he was only re-educating the woman on how to use the electrical stimulator in the office's practice, though the woman felt the need to report to a hospital afterward. So unfortunately for the good doctor, his plan failed because the woman still told someone her boss is a sadistic moron. So she's still telling tales. And now he's going to jail. Poor, poor guy. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Even generations after his death, science continues to prove Albert Einstein right. His theory of general relativity predicted the existence of gravitational waves, a theory that scientists announced the potential discovery of just last week. To talk about it, we have science writer Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, back on the program to talk about it. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and he joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Now, I initially wanted to talk to you about Planet Nine. That's that planet that was supposedly discovered somewhere beyond Pluto. But this is now bigger news. But both of those stories came out last week. What I want to know is, based on gravitational waves or the idea of gravitational waves, are these stories connected?
No. I mean, these are two very, very separate stories, I think. And you know, one of these stories, the one about Planet Nine, is really a local cosmic neighborhood story. And this other one of gravitational waves really encompasses the entire universe and our knowledge of the universe at large. So finding Planet Nine, really a planet beyond Pluto, is really something completing a puzzle that's, you know, that's really local, the solar system.
Okay,
it's a very different story.
So describe then what gravitational waves allegedly are.
So simply, I mean, you can think of it as for instance, what scientists have come up with as a great analogy is like throwing a pebble into a pond, and you have the ripples coming out from that splash that you've made. Now, if you sort of put that into the big picture of the universe, then those ripples are really the gravitational waves we're talking about. Those ripples traveling through the cosmos, through the universe, and sort of creating this ripple or wave, shock wave in the fabric of space and time. So what's happening is that when you have a very large explosion, like a huge, enormous, massive star goes supernova, or in the case of this particular discovery, we have two black holes that have collided together, and in that instant of collision, they've actually created this massive explosion. And we are 1.3 billion light years away from that explosion, and we were able to actually detect those shock waves from that. And this is the first time that we're able to do this, detect gravitational waves. Our instruments have never been sensitive enough to be able to pick that up. And this new instrument called LIGO, which is actually two instruments, one based in Louisiana and the other one in Washington State, were able to independently confirm the detection of these waves that basically washed over our entire planet. And gravitational waves are something very different, because when we look at the universe and what we have, as we have since the cavemen were looking up at the stars, we can only observe it as through light, through the electromagnetic spectrum. So that's everything from visible light, infrared light, ultraviolet light, radio waves, microwaves, all the parts of the spectrum of light. That's the only way we've been able to look at the cosmos. Now, suddenly, we have a whole new window opening up for us in the form of gravitational waves. And this is exciting astronomers, because we think we'll be able to confirm the existence of theoretical objects like binary black holes, two black holes that are orbiting each other and colliding. This has been in theory. Now we know they exist because we've detected this the signature, and other exotic objects that we don't even know yet exist. It's in our imagination. We don't know what more there is, but we do know that gravitational waves are produced by the most massive explosive events, most energetic events in the universe.
Well, I think you just partially answered my next question, and that is, as I said in the introduction, it was a theory that Einstein had, so we knew it was there in theory. Does the discovery of it change anything for scientists, since they had believed the theory anyway, or does this send them on a new path?
It's both, because it does confirm that we are on our knowledge of the universe is on the right track. The astrophysics that we came up, the theoretical astrophysics, was bang on. And it's amazing to think that Einstein came up with this theoretical notion of gravitational waves, and now exactly 100 years later, we can confirm it. And this is pretty much the last part of the general theory of relativity that we can check off on the box, that we've actually confirmed the existence. Einstein was very skeptical that we would ever be able to confirm it, but sure enough, we have a century later, and now we open up a complete new chapter in understanding the universe. So we're going to be very, what's exciting, things that we think we can do now, we're pretty sure, is once we calibrate these instruments of how and characterize different sources of these gravitational waves so that we understand their signatures in terms of gravitational waves, we'll be able to start basically dissecting some of these explosive events, like supernova. Gravitational waves will actually arrive to our detectors here on Earth days before the actual explosion is visible in the electromagnetic spectrum, meaning that we won't see the flash of light for 3-4 days after, only after the detection of the gravitational waves. So this gives us a heads up, sort of a preview of what is going to happen to a supernova. And we can actually peer into the center, the core, the heart of stars with this kind of capability. This is going to unlock the idea of how stars like our sun are born, how massive stars become black holes. We'll be able to examine black holes and the inner clockworks of these cosmic predators like never before. And also take a census of how many of these binary black holes, these black holes that circle each other, how many could there be in the universe, or other exotic objects like neutron stars, pulsars, and really large clusters of galaxies that can warp space and time around them. So we're going to be able to really understand the inner clockwork of the universe, and even perhaps look at the Big Bang, of understanding how that happened. So, there's a lot of possibilities. This is why it's so exciting. There's one researcher who actually likened this discovery of gravitational waves to when Galileo first turned the newly invented telescope to the universe and suddenly saw so many wonders that were hidden from our from the naked eye before. So it's a really new chapter in astronomy.
Okay, so besides the scientists who are all giddy about this, is there anybody on the other side? And by that I mean, with the exception of, you know, maybe some uneducated rappers and the Flat Earth Society, is there anyone who's debating this?
No, I think it's pretty much accepted amongst the community. It was amazing because even some of the most well-known astrophysicists who weren't involved in this study were saying, you know, trying to keep themselves calm and say, try to remain as skeptical as possible, because we've had sort of, you know, false alarms before. And, you know, but the fact that there were, you know, this was such a rigorous science study, it's really hard to debate. And there were two different separate detectors in different parts of the world that actually made this detection independently, really means that this was a true signal.
The reason why, again, at the beginning I brought up Planet Nine was your description of gravitational waves with the rock in the water. The water is displaced because of a rock we might not see.
That's right. And if you look at the Planet Nine, I can see your point there. And Planet Nine is very interesting because it is displacing other objects in the outer solar systems and basically controlling potentially their orbits, right? So there is that very interesting thing. I mean, but Planet Nine hasn't been confirmed yet. There is we've only been able to discover its existence through mathematical modeling and computer simulations, but it has not yet been actually observed directly. That's what that race is going on currently, right now, around the world. Major telescopes, including space observatories like the Hubble, are being trained on the sky. They think they know what part of the sky to look at, and they're trying to spot this extremely distant planet on the edge of our solar system.
All fascinating stuff. Quite the week in science. I don't know how we can top that, or if we can top that, but we have, you know, a full year to find out.
Oh, there's going to be many, many more, Peter, amazing discoveries made because of this gravitational wave announcement. You just stay tuned.
I will, and we look forward to talking to you. And in the meantime, how can people find you, sir?
Well, folks can actually visit me on my website, thenightskyguy.com, my Facebook page, also Night Sky Guy, or Twitter. And of course, they can also read my weekly sky watching column at National Geographic News.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Clear skies.
Andrew Vizekas, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And of course, you can go to thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0339, and you'll find that link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Class action lawsuits play an important role in our justice system. They can make it easier for large groups of people who have been injured or harmed to obtain justice by sharing legal representation. However, a petition filed recently with the U.S. Supreme Court reveals that an alarming number of class action lawsuits are enriching the lawyers while their clients get almost nothing. For example, a class action lawsuit filed over a popular brand of batteries resulted in a payday for the lawyers of $5.7 million, but their clients got less than $350,000 combined. Put another way, the lawyers got 94% of the settlement money, while their clients got only 6%. That's only 5 cents for each of the 7 million folks who were harmed. Let's be fair. Compare that to the already high 33% charged by most of the contingency fee lawyers advertising on TV, and we can see just how outrageous that is. So how can this happen? Learn how by visiting our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the actress and screenwriter behind the film Experiment 77. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Stick around for that. We don't have enough time for Stuff File news because we're running behind the clock here this week. But I still want to remind you that you're listening to a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. So let's get right to our next guest, shall we? Kim Kopf is an actress and screenwriter. She has written a horror drama set in a mental hospital called Experiment 77, which takes place at an underfunded and forgotten mental institution called Safe Haven. Kim joins us from California via Skype to talk about her film. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Now, my dad worked for 23 years as a nursing attendant at a psychiatric institution. So I know how scary these places can be.
Oh, wow. I bet you have some stories.
Oh, I have a few. So what made you decide to set this film in a mental institution? Where did the story come from?
Well, it originated, I was started writing it as a form of therapy. A family member was put into a mental institution against her will. And it would just started, I was not able to help her and 3,000 miles away. And so I started writing, just trying to get my thoughts out, you know, the horror that she was going through. And eventually just turned into a screenplay. And it was originally a psychological thriller, but then it was really horrifying. So I thought, why not just make it into a horror, you know, and really dig into all the drama and all the hardships that she had while being in there.
Well, you said it started out as a psychological thriller, but turned into a horror story, kind of. Did you know as you were writing it where your story was going, or were you learning the story as you were writing it?
I was learning the story as I was writing it. Again, I was writing as therapy, and I just had to get my thoughts out, you know, because I was just so devastated about what was going on. And it was just basically just started writing, and it just started developing. So it is based on a true story, but of course, you know, it's the entertainment industry, and I did, add some other elements to it. But I didn't know where it was going.
Okay,
you know, I just started writing.
Okay, so you say it started as therapy. Along the way, because you're an actress, along the way, when did you say, you know, this is more than therapy, this is actually something we can turn into a film?
Well, actually, one of my girlfriends that was helping me jot things down here and there, you know, just as being a great friend, she said, you know what, this seems like it could be a really great story, you know, to put on the screen and would really maybe benefit other people, you know, that are going through the same similar experiences. You know, I don't know anybody that hasn't had some kind of a connection to somebody with mental illness or hospitals or, you know, having a friend or a relative, a neighbor, somebody that has gone through, you know, that sort of an experience as part of like maybe being in a hospital or having the wrong medication, you know, and not being able to get the right medication, being over-medicated. There's so many elements to it. So I'm excited to really get it out there.
Well, hospitals, in a way, are kind of a scary place because it's a place where you, as you just described, be it wrong medication or being held against your will or whatever the case may be, is a place where you as a person loses control.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's almost like, you know, just recently I've been visiting a relative in a rehab facility, and it is almost like people that work there, I'm not saying everybody, but some people, they can just, you know, say, well, this person is in here because they're mentally unstable, so this must have happened, you know, and I think that's really unfair. I think that people can be taken advantage of.
In other words, the nurse ratchets of the world is what you're talking
about. Yes, the nurse ratchets, exactly. Olivia West in my story.
Okay, well, yes, tell us about the plot line. I mean, we've discussed where it takes place, but what exactly is the story and who are some of the characters?
Okay, so there's this young and beautiful girl named Rose Adams, and she's an emotionally distraught, and she ends up being getting thrown into this institution. And this institution is underfunded. It's a forgotten mental institution, so nobody's really looking at it. You know, they don't know really what's going on in there. And she ends up being the person that is actually that Nurse Ratched, and that's Olivia West, is going after as a puzzle piece to something that she's doing revolving around experiments and drug corruption. I don't want to give too much away, but also there's a Dr. Daniel Miller, and he comes in innocently. He lost his brother was actually killed in the institution. So he comes back to town to try to figure out what happened to him. And he ends up being coerced from Olivia into coming and working in the institution. And he is somebody that Rose, this character, goes to for help. And so he's caught in between, do I believe this girl? Do I not believe this girl? And what is really happening in this institution? And it also touches on like the drug corruption, pharmaceutical companies, and just, you know, how they give out all these medicines and how there's too many given to each patient and the consequences to that.
So it really is a story for our times.
It is. It really is, yeah. And again, it's just written as a horror.
So where does it stand now? What stage are you in getting this film made?
We're really close to getting the upfront half of our funding, and then we have pretty much a guarantee on the back half. So we should know within a month. So it's looking really good.
And what are your hopes for as far as a release date is concerned? When will we be able to see this film?
Well, I'm hoping to film it this summer, say July or August, and then go into post probably in, you know, September, and hopefully get it out by the beginning of next year.
Now, you're also an actress. Is there a role in there for you?
Oh, absolutely. I'll be playing Olivia West. So I get a great evil Nurse Ratched role.
Now, why did you pick that role for yourself?
Because it's fun. It's always fun to play the bad person, right?
Right. They you often hear these stories that there aren't enough well-written roles for women out there in Hollywood. Is one of the reasons you decided to also be a screenwriter was if you can't find the role, create the role?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I with my husband, I moved up to the Bay Area from Los Angeles, and I just thought, you know what? I love to write, and it's going to be another vehicle for me, you know, especially being away from the everyday grind of LA. I thought, you know what? I'm going to start writing. And I did. And I've written some scripts that I'm really proud of. I'm working right now with a writer that I met on a set up here in San Francisco, Steve Nichols, and we're working on a script. It's called Shadow Maker, and it's based on a true story, and it revolves around somebody who's a Navy SEAL, and it's like basically a love story. Anyway, so I'm really proud of that. We'll be done with that within a few months.
Your training as an actress and being in front of the camera and being on stage, how does that help you as a screenwriter?
It just helps me with the characters, you know, making them really interesting and giving them just, you know, different qualities, maybe an impediment, you know, just making them just a little bit more offbeat, maybe, you know, just a different quality. And I'm very visual when I'm writing. So I just think about, you know, the scene. And I guess I think about acting, you know, in it. And I guess it's just helpful that way.
The film is called Experiment 77. Is there a website where people can find out more information about it?
Yeah, they can go on Facebook. It's on there. And then I have my website is kimkopf.com. And also on Facebook, I'm Kim Kopf Inch. So you can always get updates to the projects I'm working on that too.
And so that they know what we're saying here as far as the spelling is concerned, it's KIMKOPF.com, correct?
Correct. Yes, .com.
Exactly. Kim, looking forward to seeing when this film comes out. Will you come back and talk with us when we're getting closer to a release date?
I most definitely will. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us, Kim.
Okay, have a wonderful evening.
Screenwriter and actress Kim Kopp. The film she has written and will star in is called Experiment 77. You can find out more info by going to her website at kimkopf.com. That's KIMKOPF.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0339, and you'll find the link. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
It didn't take long for Boston police to track down three suspects in an armed convenience store robbery. Authorities say the men were all wearing court-ordered GPS devices for unrelated cases, which placed them inside the Dorchester store and allowed investigators to track them to an apartment a block away. Police say the suspects entered the store at 6 p.m. Wednesday. All three wore masks and one had a gun. They made off with cash and cigarettes. All three pleaded not guilty at their arraignment. Two had their bail revoked in prior cases. A third is being held on $50,000 bail. The prosecutor says their GPSs pinged to the store at the time of the robbery. Police also found evidence in the apartment that tied them to the robbery. Now why? Oh, why? If you're wearing GPS monitors, would you think it prudent, along with two other GPS monitor-wearing lunkheads, to commit another crime? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0339. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0339. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.